Welcome to another episode of Living an Alter Life. My name is Mike, and coincidentally, we have another Mike on the podcast this week, and one of my favorite race directors, because he is the Dome race director, one of the two, Mr. Mike Melton. Mike, you ready to go for a little run?
I am, Mike. Thanks for having me.
You got it. So let's get this out of the way first. Did you end up finishing DFL in the 10-day?
I did. Only awesome. Because Bad Mike Dobies said, you know, so again, there's a background and context to everything. So because I'm inside the building for the 11 days and because I have a running streak going, I would like to get miles in every day. And I'm a little conflicted and I feel a little guilty at times about taking time away from my job to get personal stuff done. But, you know, it's like 45 minutes start to finish. And so I figure I can shoehorn it in. I do a minimum. I calculated the minimum number of laps necessary to get my 2 miles. And I could go out of the building, and right behind the building is the Hank Aaron Trail that cuts through Milwaukee. It's an urban rail to trail. But I don't want to be like a mile away from the building if something goes sideways or the blows up or comes apart. I want to be 3 or 4 minutes away. So, and if I'm going to run on the track during the race, I need to be a registered runner because we just don't let people on the track during the contest. So Bill has almost always just walked the track in the opposite direction just to check on things occasionally. But Dobies and I were sitting around at Capital Backyard Ultra and we were talking about how chilly it can be to sit inside the dome. Because unlike you guys, the runners, where you're moving and generating heat, we're not generating nearly as much heat.
Exactly.
So he said to me, you know, I might get up and take a couple of laps when I get chilled. And I said, do it, man. And he said, I'll put a bib on. So when I loaded up all the runner data, I put all three of us in as entrants. And then when Matt Zalesnik, our paramedic EMT guy, arrived, I put him in. And so anytime we were on the track, we were just going to get miles. And so cool. I think Matt ended up with about 60 kilometers and Bill got a 50K in. And I did my minimum number of laps on the days that I needed to. And I think I ended up with like 22 miles. Okay. And Mike Dobies had like 10 laps, but he said to me at the beginning of the race, I don't want my result published. I'm just doing laps to stay warm. And so at the end, I'm going to take my name out. Sunday afternoon when I published the results, I just deleted his name. So his name no longer appears. So in the official results, I am DFL.
Awesome. Awesome. So much fun. Well, Mike, tell us a little bit about yourself and how you got into this very strange sport of ultra running and what all you do, because you're not just a race director. You're not just a timer. You're also quite an accomplished runner as well. So go ahead.
I've had my moment in the sun, not very many, and they weren't very impressive, but I've probably run, I don't know, 700 or 800 races, 40 some marathons, 3 Bostons. So I grew up in Michigan, suburban Detroit, had a great, you know, middle class upbringing. I went to Central Michigan University, got a degree in chemistry and was a chemist. I worked at Dow Chemical while I was in college, and that's how I paid my way through school. And then I spent 5 years at DuPont as a chemist back in the Detroit area. We did automotive paint. And, and then I decided I wanted more control over my life. So I went off and did more independent stuff. My start in running went like this. Seventh grade, I'm not the sharpest knife in the drawer, but I can see that all the cute chicks only pay attention to the jocks. So I'm going to need to be a jock. And in Michigan in the fall, you play football. And so I joined the football team. And man, what a mistake. The first time my buddy Gary Sabol knocked me on my ass, I was like, I'm out, dude. This is not for me. So now it's wintertime and basketball is a big sport in Michigan. And I'm tall, but I'm white, man. I'm not coordinated. I got no jump. I got no speed. I got no agility. I got nothing. And I worked really hard trying to make basketball work, but it just didn't work. So springtime rolls around and I'm getting desperate. It's a choice between baseball, which is sort of like basketball, hand-eye coordination, speed, agility, all that stuff, or track and field. Now, track and field, on the first day, they put everybody on the track and they do tryouts. If you're fast, you're a sprinter. If you can jump, you're a high jumper, long jumper. If you can throw stuff, you're a shot putter or discus or whatever. If you got no talent, you are a distance guy. So I'm a 2 miler. And that's how I ended up getting a varsity letter.
Oh my God, that is awesome.
So I ended up doing 4 years of cross country, 4 years of track and field, and I did 3 years of swimming. That was the wintertime sport. And so I ended up with 10 varsity letters in the 4 years of being on high school sports. And when I got, I went to college and I went and talked to the cross country coach, and he said, if you can't run 32 minutes or faster for a 10K, then we can't use you. And I was like, well, dude, I don't think I could run 40 minutes for a 10K. So so I was out.
That is awesome.
And, you know,
that is awesome.
And like everyone else, you do your college stuff. I did intramural sports once in a while. Then I ran a little bit. I jumped into a few races while I was in college, you know, because road racing was just like, I was born at the perfect time for running, because okay, I came of age during the first golden age of U.S. running, when okay, Frank Shorter won the gold medal in Munich, you know, yep, 1972. I was like a freshman in high school when he won the gold. When he won the silver in Munich in 76, I was second year in college. And I was in my formative years when Bill Rogers won 4 New York and 4 Boston marathons in a row, when Greg wow, Myers dominated for a while, when Steve Prefontaine lit up the track. That yep, was my era. Those were my heroes. And it was a golden time to be a runner. And today's kids don't have that. I really grew up in a magical time for U.S. running.
Yeah, definitely.
And me and all my cross country and track guys, we caught the fire and it just never extinguished itself. When I got out of college and started running road races, the 20 to 24 and 25 to 29 was the toughest, deepest age group. When I was in my 40s, the 40 to 44 and 45 to 49 were the toughest, deepest age groups. When I was in my 50s, same thing. And yeah, a lot of us now that we're in our 60s, same thing. So, you know, what happened for me running wise was that I got out of college and I got out in January. I was a 4.5 year student because I could work all summer long full time at Dow Chemical. And I made a boatload of money. I made enough money to buy a house. And so January, I get a job at DuPont. By like late February or early March, I realized I put on like 30 pounds.
Oh my gosh.
Because I'm not exercising. I would come home after work and I would pop a beer and I would think, what am I going to have for dinner? And I'd look in the fridge and I'd look around and I'd pop another beer and I'd look in the closet and in the pantry and I'd pop another beer. And pretty soon I'd have like 4 or 5 beers and a bag of chips or a pizza. And man, by mid-March, I was bloated. I'm thinking, this is bad. I got to do something. So March 29th of 1980, I went for a 1 mile run after work. And the next time I missed a day was June of 1989.
Oh my gosh, nine
so
years.
I went,
wow.
I went like 9 years, 45 days without missing a day's run.
That's incredible.
And I need motivation. Any given day, there's a reason why I don't have time to run, or I can't figure it out, or it's the weather's too bad, or something, I'm too busy, I got to drive too much, whatever it is. But if I have a streak going, I think to myself, well, you know, if I miss today, I got to start all over again. And dang, why would I want to do that? Let's figure it out. Let's get 35 minutes and get 2 miles in somewhere. So that's my motivation. That's what keeps me out there. And if I can do 2 miles a day, every day, then once in a while, I'll do, like Sunday morning, my buddy John and I did 5.6 miles. And the day before, I'd done 5 miles with another friend doing some trails in our area. So, you know, I'll get longer runs in occasionally, but 2 miles a day keeps a base level of fitness that I can then yep, ramp up rather exactly, than starting from zero, and being overweight, out of shape, having no cardio. At least I have a base. So that's my story and I'm sticking to it.
That is awesome. That is amazing. Yeah. And you've got another streak going now, don't you? How long is your current streak?
I do. It's whatever, however many days from January 1. So I run every day of 2025. Okay.
Awesome.
That's now what's 188 days or something like that.
Yeah. So, somewhere in there.
So Yeah, so how I got into ultras was the usual progression. When I got out of college and I started running road races in the late 70s and early 80s, it was 10Ks. I ran the Pepsi 10K, and we have 10Ks downtown Detroit. We had local 10Ks. I ran one at the Pontiac Silverdome. They were all of those. And so then, of course, if you're going to run with people in a race, they're almost always somebody in that race is going to be talking about a marathon that they're doing.
Yeah.
And, you know, and as I said, you know, we had Bill Rogers and Frank Shorter and Greg Myers and all these people, you know, Bob Campanian and Tony Sandoval and all these guys running great marathons and being really competitive and dominating in the world as much as any other country. And so 1979, I ran my first marathon, the Detroit Free Press Marathon. I think I ended up running seven or eight of them. And it was not a pretty sight because my longest run ever in my life before that marathon was the Old Kent Riverbank 25K, which was 15.5 miles. And in my training leading up to Free Press, the long run was like 13 miles. And I remember getting to mile 16, just past mile 16, there's a guy, we're coming out of Grosse Pointe, Michigan, which was the Tony suburbs on the river. We're coming out of there, headed back towards downtown Detroit. And there's one guy standing alongside of the street, and he's clapping his hands and saying, "You people look great, only 10 miles to go." And that hit me like a ton of bricks. Like, holy shit. Because I had just been thinking, I've now run further than I ever have in my entire life. And now some guy's telling me I have 10 more miles.
Yeah, that's the hardest part of a marathon.
I completely unraveled. Oh, my God, it was horrible. It was one of my two marathons that were slower than 4 hours. I ran like a 4:33. And back in those days, at 4 hours, they were cleaning up the course, man. I mean, you needed to be off that course because who the hell would run that slow?
Exactly.
You know? And I can tell you that out of 3,300 people that ran, I finished like 3,100. So wow. I was within the final 200 people on the course. And I came back the next year and I'm a slow learner. So I didn't train anymore. I didn't do any more long runs. And I ran a 4:25.
Wow.
And I thought to myself, damn, I know I'm better than this. So the third year, I thought maybe there is something to these long runs. So I did like 16 runs of 15 miles or longer. I did 10 runs of 18 or longer. I did five that were over 20 miles. And I ran like a 3:16. So I cut an hour and 9 minutes off my time.
Just by training. What a novel idea, huh? Wow. Who would have thought that if you actually trained for a marathon, you could, you know, kick butt?
So back then, everybody who entered a marathon, the goal was qualify for Boston.
Okay.
Now, in those days, in my age group, which was, you know, 39 and under, I had to run a 2 hour, 50 minute or better marathon to get to Boston.
You're
and
kidding
250,
me.
Like, no, it was awful. I mean, it was a hell of a hard qualifier. You remember the days of the big wide paper that had the tractor feed edges?
Yes.
And it was fan folded, and it would fan out and they would just run forever. So at the lab I was working at, we had bought a brand new gas chromatograph. It had a big wide tractor feed paper thing. And there was a little program that they included in the software where they could print banners like happy birthday. So I had the tech print me a banner that said 249.59 or better. And I had it hung up in my office and it hung there for 4 years and I couldn't come close. I mean, the best I had was a 308. So finally, 1988, I finally qualified for Boston because they eased the standard from 250 to 3 hours.
And
in Melbourne, Space Coast Marathon. Now, the Space Coast Marathon these days is a pretty big event. They draw about 1,000 people for the marathon and about 4,000 for the half. But the year I ran in 1988, there were 58 finishers, and I was fifth overall. And I won my age group with a 2:57.59. I was 5 minutes behind the winner.
Wow. That's amazing. I can't believe there were only 58 people in the marathon.
58. But this was 1988, man. And Florida was not, I mean, the population boom really hadn't hit. And marathoning down, you know, running in Florida, it's mostly old people. I mean, so we had a small but hearty running community down here, and I had my choice. I could have run the Space Coast Marathon on Saturday, which was smaller and the course was less scenic, or I could go Sunday to Miami and run the Orange Bowl Marathon, which had about 1,000 people in it. But I was nervous about Miami being too hot, and I made the right call, because Melbourne, we started in the high 60s and the temperature was in the mid 70s when we finished. And in Miami, it started at 79 degrees and went up into the 80s. I never would have qualified if I'd have gone to Miami.
Yeah.
And so
plus
I
the
ran,
humidity, I'm sure.
Yeah. I ran on like February 25th, and I had to have my application had to be at the Boston Athletic Association on March 1st. So Monday, I FedExed my application along with a copy of my finish certificate to Boston. They got it on Tuesday, and Wednesday I got in and I ran in April.
Wow. That's amazing. Okay,
can't
so
do that
1988
anymore.
was your first Boston, right?
Yep.
That's a,
and
so
so
how'd
I
you
ended
do?
up running. I ran like a 3:26. I was still recovering from the sub 3 hour because it was only like 5 weeks between them.
Right.
And it was a busy time. I really didn't have enough time to do much training, and I wanted my Boston experience to be a true experience. Like, I didn't want to be so focused on racing that I didn't look around, that I didn't like check things out, that I didn't think about the experience. And so it was really, it's a wonderful race. Boston's an incredible race to do. I think I was had just turned 30, and then I qualified one or two more times in my 30s. And then 10 years later in 1998, I qualified again. I was 39 when I ran my race, but I would have been 40 on race day at Boston. So you get to the qualifying level you have to meet is the qualifier on race day. So I ran my qualifier as a 39-year-old and then ran Boston as a 40-year-old.
That's awesome. Yeah, I like that.
And so I ran 88, 98, and then I ran again in 2005. When my second wife, she had just qualified for Boston at her first marathon in Disney. And so I said, well, I got a qualifier, let's go. And so we went and ran in 2005. And I really screwed up, because like 2016 or 17, I should have made another push to qualify again and run in 2018 or 19. Because then I could have run in four decades, the 80s, the 90s, the
0s.
And so I kind of screwed that up.
All right, so you got to qualify in the 2025s now.
I know, yeah. That's probably not going to happen. So again, I did the progression. I did the 10Ks and the 5Ks, the half marathons. I did the marathons. I lost count after 40 some marathons.
Okay.
I don't think I made it to 50, but I was definitely more than 40. And I started down the pathway of the 50 states and DC thing.
Yeah.
And I started blitzkrieging them. Like, I literally spent like 32 hours in Philadelphia. I flew in.
Gosh.
I'm sorry. It was like 26 hours, because I flew in Saturday afternoon. I made it to the packet pickup with 2 minutes to spare. I got up in the morning. I jogged to the race. I ran the race. I walked back to the hotel. I showered. I went to the airport and I flew home.
Oh my gosh.
And I ran like a 3:28. I mean, I walked, I think, 12 or 13 times, you know, because I started doing the run walk thing. And I did Marine Corps. The 30th year of Marine Corps was my year. And I got to like 20 some states. And I thought, you know, this is feeling like a chore, not like a fun thing.
I have heard that from other people. Yeah.
All the races started looking the same. Like, I would show up in some random city. I'd run some random course. It'd be a bunch of the same people. You know, I'd see clocks and finish lines and then bug out of town. And I sort of lost my mojo for the 50 marathons thing at about 23 states. I did run some very nice marathons. Big Sur was a really beautiful race. I was really nervous about Big Sur because of the hills, because Florida is not very hilly. And so the day before, I drove the course and I counted the number of hills, because I wanted to know when I crested a hill, how many more I had left. And it's 28 hills from the start to the finish. So I crossed hill number 10, I would say 18 more to go. When I crossed number 20, I got 8 more hills to go. You know?
And hope you didn't miscount, right?
Exactly. And so,
Yeah.
now I get it. Now I'm in my mid to late 40s, starting to get late 40s. And, Father Time is undefeated. You just cannot outrun Father Time.
Nope.
And sooner or later, you can't do the workouts that you did. Or if you can do them, it takes longer to recover. It's a lot harder to pile up the mileage. I was a pretty steady 50 to 75 mile a week guy for a lot of years. And you start losing your speed and you think, well, what's my mojo now? What's my reason? What's my why? Why is it I'm going to get up and run? Why am I going to do these miles? You can say to yourself, at 85, I want to be healthy and have an active life. But at 46, when the alarm clock goes off, it's a whole lot easier just to roll over one more day and not get out of bed because
Yep.
85 is 40 friggin' years away. So my why became, if I can't go faster, can I go farther? How much farther can I go? So, I sort of dabbled with ultras, started doing ultras. So a couple of buddies of mine and I in our training group here in Florida, they started running ultras and started doing trails. So we started running in the local state park. So one of my buddies and I signed up. I did the Croom 50 miler and I dropped out at 35 miles. And then I did the JFK 50 and I finished.
Awesome.
And not bad. And my goal was to finish without using my headlamp. And I finished just as it got dark. I never turned my headlamp on. It's like, I don't know, 10 hours and 12 minutes or something like that. And it wasn't bad. It's a great race. Really, I enjoyed that race. I don't feel the need to go back, but
Yep.
I really enjoyed running that race. That it
Yeah,
was
I'm
once was
exactly
fine
the
for me.
same. I ran it one time. I was like, okay, that was good. It was, it was iconic. It was a lot of fun. The scenery was
Exactly.
beautiful.
Exactly.
The course is amazing. The
Exactly.
people are incredible. Like,
I
okay.
love the towpath. Man, I just put it on autopilot and ran,
Yeah.
So I want to say JFK was 2003, late
Okay.
2003 for me because of
Okay.
November. And then 2004, one of my buddies said, "Hey, I'm gonna enter the Umstead 100 miler." I said, "I'll go with you," because it was time for me to try 100. And
Right.
so Bob and I went up to run Umstead, and I went through mile 50 and like 10:15, I was like 3
Wow.
minutes slower than my JFK time, and I felt pretty good. And my goal was to run the flats and the downhills, walk the uphills, and have fun.
Yep.
So mile 50 to 60, I had more difficulty running the flats, and from 60 to 70, I walked most of it. And
Okay.
I got into it, this was back in the days where it was 10 mile loops, and like the
Yep.
first three or four loops, you had to go down to the damn lake and do the dock. You had to run
Yep.
this dock. You had to go out on the dock, come back. And so, anyways, I come into that the lodge there at the my after mile 70, and I said, "That's it, I'm done." And he said, "What do you mean?" I said, "I came here to run and have fun. I'm not doing either, and it's not worth it, And so, like, I'm sitting by the fire there, and drinking a hot chocolate or something. And my buddy Bob comes in, and he says, "Hey, what's up?" I said, "I'm done. I'm done." He said, "Well, then I am too." And I was like, "Dude, don't quit on my behalf." He said, "No." He said, "I think I'm done too." So we went and slept in my van, got up in the morning, and went home. And so now I'm thinking, well, I got to try again. So I signed up for Old Dominion. It's in June,
Okay.
and it's only the Appalachians. How hard can
Yeah,
it be?
no
So what the hell?
problem.
I mean, it's not like it's the Rockies, And so I drive up to Old Dominion, and I start running the race. And I'm about, I don't know, 20 miles in, and I start up this hill. I'm on a trail, and I start uphill, and I say to myself, okay, I'm gonna walk to the top of this and then run down. And 93 minutes later, I was still walking uphill because it was a long uphill. And I get to the top. I get to the top, and I crest over the top, and I start downhill. And it's so steep that I can't run. Like, I'm having trouble not falling down the mountain. And I was so discouraged. And I got to mile 43, and I said, "I'm done. I quit." And I said, "What do you mean?" I said, "Well, look. I have to power hike the uphills. I can't run the downhills because they're too damn steep. This is not my race." So some guy gave me a ride back to the finish line. I get in my car and all the way home, I'm thinking to myself, I'm just not cut out. I'm not tough enough for 100 milers. I'm too much of a pussy. I can't do this. And
Okay.
so I get home I get home and Bob and my buddies, you know, we're talking about it and they're thinking, ah. And so it must have been late summer. Bob says to me, hey, you should try another 100 miler. I said, no, nah, Bob, man, I've DNF twice. I mean, screw this. I'm done. I'm not tough. I'm just too wussy. He said, no, try another one. He says, in fact, he says, I'm going to do this race up in Titusville, up there by the Cape, like Cape Canaveral, I guess it is, because it's a Kennedy Space Center. He said, I'm going to do this race up there. It's called Ancient Oaks 100 miler. He said, but you got to call the race director and he's got to interview you. And I was like, oh, really? I said, I don't know. But Bob said, no, call this guy. His name is Stu. So I call this guy, Stu Gleeman. And I say, Stu, I'd like to run your Ancient Oaks 100 miler. And he says, well, what have you done so far? I said, well, I have DNF'd Umpsted and I DNF'd at Old Dominion. He said, well, you haven't done shit. And I said, nope, I have not. And that's awesome. He says, are you going to give me any trouble? And I said, he said, can you take care of yourself? Can you be responsible? And I said, oh, yeah. I'm good self-crewing. He said, okay, I'll let you run. So I went up there. And even though it got down to like 29 degrees at 4 in the morning, it was one of the cold snap days. I gutted it out and I finished in like 29 hours and 55 minutes. There it was a 32 hour cutoff. So I was within the cutoff, but I finished that one. I finished four more. So I have five in a row, Ancient Oaks. Awesome. I finished 2004, 5, 6, 7, and 8. And about 3 years in, I said to Stu, if you ever decide that you don't want to do this race anymore or can't do it for some reason, please don't let it die. This is an outstanding race. I would love to step in and help if you need it. And so after 2008, he called me in January and he said, you know, were you serious about that? I said, serious as a heart attack, man. I would be thrilled to step in. And he said, well, I'm getting too old and I'm getting to be too much of a curmudgeon. I'm pissing a lot of people off and it's just not fun anymore. So 2009 was my first race director debut as an ultra race director. I'd race directed like 500 or 600 5Ks and 10Ks and half marathons in our local area. But that was my first ultra. And Stu was there to help. It was the transition year. And so this is now my, let's see, this year will be the 26th year. No, the 27th. December will be 27 years for Ancient Oaks. And it'll be my 17th year as race director.
That is awesome. See, and that was going to be my next question was, how did you get into the race directing? So you already answered it. That is awesome. So Ancient Oaks was your first one, your first ultra.
It wasn't. So when I moved to Florida, I moved to an area that's primarily tourists and retirees. So there was a small band of running people, but not much. Small groups, 3 and 4 people here, a couple of people there, you know. But I came out of the Detroit area where we had a vibrant community. I was a member of 3 running clubs. You know, the Redford Roadrunners, the Novi Trackers, and the Motor City Striders. And I got to Florida, and there was no such thing as a club. I mean, there was barely a few people running. And we had like 2 races all the whole year. And they were pretty poorly done because the people who were doing them just really didn't understand what a good race was all about. So I moved down in January of 86, and October of 86, a guy moved down from Wisconsin, and he had grown up in the Milwaukee area, and he was an NAIA All-American at the marathon, and he got a job at the local hospital. He was going to be the director of their fitness center program, because that was back when hospitals decided the way to get business was to open fitness centers and get people in and keep them healthy. And then when they got sick, they'd already be predisposed to come into the hospital because they'd already know the organization. So my wife at the time, I had gotten married in June of that year. So we were pretty much newlyweds, but she was working at the hospital and she was in benefits and HR, and she did a lot of the new employee processing. So she's sitting there with this guy, Dave, and Dave says to her, hey, you know, I do a lot of running. Do you know anybody who runs? Barb says, my husband runs. So we hooked up together and we started doing training runs. And for me, when he would do a moderate run, that was a hard ass workout for me because, you know, his marathon PR was 2:29 and mine was still over 3 hours. So, you know, I was stepping up to run with him. But I learned that that's a great way to get in shape is to train with people who are better than you are because you're going to naturally want to keep up with them. And so Dave and I did all these long runs, and we had a deal where we'd meet on Sunday afternoons or Sunday evening, really like 5, 6 o'clock. And we'd do a 2 or 2.5 or so run, probably be 20 miles. In fact, I came home from one of those one night. It was a Sunday night, and it was just about dark or a little after dark. And I got back to the apartment where my wife and I were living in. And I crawled up the stairs, and I curled up on the floor of the living room in a fetal ball, and I like fell asleep. And she got, woke me up in the middle of the night and said, come on, you got to come to bed. This is bad. And in the morning, she said, what you're doing is not healthy. And I said, oh, no, it's really good. This is awesome. That was a great training run.
That's awesome. We are morons.
Oh my God. Dude, when I was in my heyday training for, trying to qualify for Boston and working at DuPont at the lab, I knew I was in shape. A coworker asked me one time, one of the other chemists came to me and said, dude, he said, Mike, he said, are you sick? Like, you don't have cancer or anything, do you? He said, you're really looking thin and emaciated. And I said, thank you. That means I'm really training hard. And I mean, I've cut all the excess weight off and I'm super fast,
Well,
we are morons, aren't we?
Yes, we are. It's amazing.
So Dave and I are now running. We're running buddies. And we're pissing and moaning about how there's no races in the area. Cause he came from, Milwaukee. Badgerland Striders is a great club. And so he and I said, well, you know what? We should start a running club. So January of 87, we had a meeting and we ended up with, 15 people. And we started a running club called the Sailfish Striders. And Dave was president for 7 years, I think, before he moved out of state. And I was vice president 21 years in a row. And we had three goals. One was to provide area runners with training partners, with people who were training at similar levels and for similar goals, so that if you were training for a 10K or a marathon or whatever, you didn't have to do all your training by yourself. We could hook you up with somebody that you could, share miles with. And the second thing we had a goal was we wanted to promote health and fitness in the general area, because our area is primarily rednecks, tourists, and retirees. Historically, it's not been a healthy population. And third, we wanted to put on races that were quality races, like races we would want to run in. Once word got out that we were putting on races, oh, dude, we got every charity and every cause come to us and say, oh, we want a race. We want you guys to put on a race for us, just like Race for the Cure, man. And, we would roll our eyes and go, well, we'll put on a race for you, but, you need to readjust your expectations here. And so, we did the cancer and the Cancer Foundation, the American Cancer Society, the Kidney Foundation, the muscular dystrophy, all the charities. The local hospital had a couple of races. And so we got really, really good at cranking out 5Ks and 10Ks with 100 to 150, 200 people, hand scored them all with a printing stopwatch and pull tags off the race bibs. Oh man, we had a really good system. We could process results. If the race started at 7 a.m. in a 5K, by 8 o'clock, we were ready to hand out awards. So an hour. And we could do awards. And we had them all posted. We had this board, a big like a port board, and we would write your time and place on your tag, and then we would post it on the board in the age group that you were in. So you could go over and say, oh, look, I'm fifth. My tag is the fifth one down. I'm fifth place. There's my time. There's my overall place. I mean, it was a great system.
That's amazing.
Worked really well up to about 300 people, 275, 300 people. The throughput at the finish line in a 5K is just too many people. Although we worked some good races. I mean, we worked a bunch of races. We did the Hemingway Days 5K one year, which is in July, and it's an evening race. And it is hotter than hell. Oh my gosh, it's so hot down there. And we had 477 people, and we had our results ready to go an hour and 15 minutes after we started the race.
Oh my gosh.
So that was a hard one.
That's amazing. So when did you switch to like the electronic timing and all that? When did that come about?
Well, there's a story about that too.
Good.
So the running club, they had given three of us lifetime memberships in the club. And so 2006, 2007, 8, we're looking at electronic timing systems because they're starting to be available at the local level. I mean, it was the mid-90s that I put a championship on at the Disney Marathon for the first time. And wow. So, you know, chip timing was really only for like the top level races like Boston and Disney and Chicago and New York. The little local races never had it because it was too expensive. It was too difficult. You know, you had to pick up your chip, and if you didn't turn it back in, they would charge you, I think, $50 or $30 or something like that.
Wow.
Because they were, you know, you had to get it back. So the systems had finally started to come down in price, and we started looking at them, and, you know, we would have $5,000 or $6,000 in the club treasury, and I'd look, and the system would cost like $8,000. And I would think, you know, we really don't have enough. And then we get $8,000 or $9,000, and I would look, and the system would cost $10,000 to $12,000. And so that went on for a couple of years. We actually had a chip timing guy come out of Fort Lauderdale and time one of our races so we could see what it looked like and what the process was. And now we're having a discussion, and we're a club. So we're all volunteer. Nobody gets paid. All the money that comes in is for the club. So we as a club would charge some charity, you know, $500 or $1,000 to put on a race, but we just put it all in the club kitty. None of us got money. When we went to Key West, I gave us all $30 for gas. That's the most anybody ever got. So now we're talking about owning, let's say we spend $12,000 on a timing system. And let's say we have 10 races that we can use it at. That means 40 weekends a year, that timing system is not being used. It's sitting in a warehouse or a garage somewhere, and it's gathering dust. And if we're not going to use it for our race, maybe we should drive to Sebring or Miami or Orlando or Melbourne and time a race there, because we can make use of the system and we can make more money with it. And now we have a hard enough time getting volunteers to show up at our local races to help out. How are we going to get a volunteer to drive 2 hours to Sebring on a Saturday morning and spend the morning and drive 2 hours back? And what, get paid? How much are they going to get paid? If they get paid, how much they get paid? Who decides who's going to pay? Who decides who gets paid and who decides who goes and who doesn't? It's really kind of a nightmare. So it's really obvious that chip timing should really be a business.
Okay.
And so I said to the club, you know, I'm going to go buy a chip timing system. And I would like to call myself Sailfish Timing and Results. And what I'll do is I'll give you guys, the club, I'll give the club a discount on my standard fee. So I'll do our races for less money. And then the races that I do that aren't club races, like in Sebring or Orlando or Miami or Melbourne, whatever I collect, I'll give the club 5 or 10% of what I collect as like an endorsement fee. And the club decided that was a shitty deal. They didn't want that deal.
Okay.
And I thought, free money. You don't want free money? Okay. And so I called myself MCM Timing and Results, and they threw me out of the club. They excommunicated me. And so for 3 or 4 years, I had said to them, I won't solicit any of the races that you guys do, you know, that you, because they were still doing 15 races a year. And I said, there's plenty of business out there, and I won't ever approach anybody that you're doing a business. But like 3 months after they threw me out, they had a meeting and they decided they were burned out and they were tired of working all these races. So they picked 3 races that they were going to keep for their own as club races. And all the rest of them, they called all those people and they said, we're not going to work your race anymore. You should call Mike Hilton.
Oh my gosh, that's amazing.
And so like in 2 years, I had all the races that I had been working before, but now I'm working them as a professional business doing chip timing. And I always did chip start to chip finish, you know, in the early days. And even today for a smaller race, you'll often find where it's gun start, where everybody's on the line and they yell go and everybody takes off and everybody gets the same starting time. And the only mat is at the finish line. And that's how the electronic results get calculated. To me, if you have the system, even if you have to move it from the start to the finish, you should do that, because that's what a chip system does. It gives you net chip time. So for me, it was about setting a higher standard. Like I want to do as much as I can for the runner to make their race the best race it can be for them.
Yep.
So I bet in 1,000 or more races that I've worked, I'll bet I've only done a gun start with a chip system twice in my life.
Wow.
And that was only because that's the race amazing. Director said, let's do it this way. It's easy. There's only a handful of people. It's not going to be a big deal. And I reluctantly agreed. But, you know, for me, it's all about, you know, giving people the best chance at having a great race. So
what year did you start MCM Timing and Results then?
That was 2009.
And is that still the name of your company?
It is. MCM That's Timing amazing. And Results LLC. Yeah.
And yeah. so went from your first race in 2009, and just how many races do you time now in a year?
I started with about 10 or 12. I was doing one or two a month.
Right.
And we now do between 90 and 100 races a year.
Oh my gosh, that is so amazing. I love success stories like that.
Well, you know, part of it is that because I ran ultras, because I was running ultras before I bought chip timing, you know, it was a natural to start thinking about timing ultras. I timed the Kroom Fools 50 miler one or two times, and I timed a couple of others over in the Brooksville area north of Tampa. And I timed a couple of other local ultras. And David Clark out of Colorado, who was a motivational speaker, really inspirational guy. He was like a 320-pound drug addicted alcoholic. And, you know, he woke up one morning in a gutter and thought, I got to change my life. And he turned his life around. He, you know, he got to 150, 60 pounds. He ran a bunch of ultras, including Badwater and Leadville and all that. So Dave, back before Facebook, we had this group called the Ultra List. It was an email listserv.
Okay.
And, you know, you sent an email to the list and everybody on the list got it. And there were 2,000 or 3,000 people on that list. And so he put up an email that said, hey, I'm going to put on a race in Longmont, Colorado. It's a 1.05 mile loop and it's going to be in September. It's going to be around September 11th. And I'm going to do it for, you know, raise money for first responders. And I'd love it if you all came out and ran. I emailed him back and I said, Dave, I said, how are you going to count your loops? And he said, how are you going to count the runners doing the loops? He said, I don't know. We'll probably have volunteers. And he said, we'll screw it all up and it'll be okay, you know? So I said to him, hey, I have this chip timing system and I've been trying to see what it would be like to time a loop race, but I'm nervous about it and I need like a guinea pig race. And your race looks like a good race. You're going to have, it was like 50 or 60 people and the loop size was good. I said, how about if I come out, if you pay my expenses, I'll come out and do it for free. And he said, oh, that's a great idea. And so this coming September 9th, I think we're going to do the 16th year of that race.
Oh, wow. And what's
American,
that race called?
It's called the American Heroes Run, and we've gone from a 9-hour, 11-minute run to there's a 100-miler that gets 30 hours. So we start Friday morning and we finish Saturday afternoon. There's a 9-hour, 11-minute run. There's a 24-hour. There's a half marathon, a marathon, a 5K, and a 9.11-mile run. And tragically, Dave went in for back surgery in May of 2020 when it was COVID, the COVID years, and never came out of the hospital. He died at age 49 in the hospital a day or two after back surgery. So his book editor, Bill, took on the race as a tribute to Dave. And so we do it in Dave's memory. Great race.
Cool.
I love being out there. Dave was such a cool guy. Really a super, super guy.
That's
it's
awesome.
A real tragedy. Real tragedy and loss. So young.
Cool.
And then I realized that loop races, you know, started to become a thing. And loop races, short loop races are one of the hardest things to get right because there are so many places that shit can go wrong. And so over the years, I've really developed a pretty robust system. I rarely have issues. This year at the Dome, not once did I have to put a manual lap in. And normally every race, there's a handful of them. But because everyone listened for the first time ever when I told them never to go backwards, they listened.
Right.
And that's why we got it right. It's because everybody, they never screwed it up. They never went backwards.
It was an amazing crowd this year at the Dome. So
Oh,
yeah,
it was great. And the Dome is another labor of love. You know, Steve Durbin had done it with Joe Fegis originally. And after the 2021 race, Durb said, "I love this race, but I can't put 2.5 weeks of my life into something and not make money at it." And so he said, "I'm not doing it next year." And so I said to him, "Would you mind if Bill and I took it over?" And he said, "No, man, have at it."
Wow.
So that's Bill and I became race directors 2022. I'm sort of the collector of lost orphan races. And
that's awesome. How many races do you direct now?
Well, let's see. I have 3 5Ks in the summer, June, July, and August. It's the Summer Sizzler Series. We just had our first one. The second one comes up at the end of this month. And then at Ultras, I picked up Picnic Island when it became orphaned in March down in Jupiter, Florida. And then I've got Skeeter Scoot, 50K, 100K,
okay.
And Lost 118, the race around Lake Okeechobee. So I have been race director on and off for a handful of events over the years. And, I've worked all of the Race for the Ages. I've worked all Biggs Backyards because I was at Biggs Backyard as a runner the first 2 years.
Wow.
But yeah, I've been at Biggs the whole time. Great
wow.
race. Biggs is a lot of fun.
Yeah, I can't imagine.
I've been really lucky over the years that I have sort of fallen into serendipity has led me into these situations. And I'm the kind of guy that says, "Oh, hell, I don't know jack shit about that, but I'll try it."
That's
you know?
Awesome. Yeah. That's incredible.
You know, I made a very conscious choice at the end of 5 years at DuPont that I either had to stay with the corporate gig and like work for the man and have the nice job and the stock and the pension and all that stuff, but sort of be shackled in the sense that I really didn't have much control over my life. You know, I had vacation and that would be about it. Or I could go out on my own and live a more precarious life in some ways because it was, you know, not as routine, but I consciously chose that I wanted a life of experiences and I wanted a life of joy and fun and happiness. I didn't want a life where I ended up with a bunch of stuff at the end.
Yeah, I'm
and
right
so
there with
I,
you.
I,
that is
so
awesome.
So I made that happen. And, I just, that was my thing, man.
That is so amazing. And so your son is doing the race timing with you also now?
So my son and I, he's been timing races since he was like 14 or 15.
Okay.
And he's been running the crew when we do a local race like a 5K or a half marathon or something, we usually have 2 or 3 or 4 staff people. And so he's run that crew since he was like 16 or 17.
Wow.
I actually had some of my staff people said to me, "Mike, we love working the races, but honestly, we like working with him better than we like working with you." And I was like, "I'm good with that. I love that."
Yep. That is so awesome.
So he went through college. He's got a business degree with statistics emphasis. And he and I have talked about, you know, does he want the business? You know, would he ever come in? And at this point, he really does not. He's got a life. He's got a great job. He works for Landstar, the third largest freight shipping company in the U.S. And he's a director. He's got 3 or 4 people working for him. He's doing a wonderful job of it. And
awesome.
When he did that, when he got his real job, I said to him, "You know, when you were a starving college student, you know, you worked a lot of my races for me. And I was able to double up on a lot of weekends because of that. But now that you have a real job, I respect the fact that you have a life and I want you to have your own life. And so I'm going to try as much as possible to extricate you out of my business so that you can have your own life." And he said, I appreciate the fact that you thought about that. He said, "Thank you for giving me that." And I said to him, "It's going to take a couple of years because we have races, a lot of races where we double books because of that." And so he said, "I'll tell you what," he said, "you asked and I will turn you down if it doesn't work for me. But if I want to, I will." And I said, "Deal." So like he loves working for the race directors for Cruel Jewel and Merrill's Mile are the same couple. He loves okay. working with them. So he works Cruel Jewel, and that weekend is my weekend to work Keys 100. Okay. And he works Merrill's Mile when it conflicts with some other event. He works the Georgia Jewel because he really likes Franklin and Jenny Baker. Sweet people. He works that because that's my weekend to work Barclay Fall Classic. So, you know, we have a whole bunch. And because he's in the Jacksonville area, any of the races we do in Jacksonville or Georgia or South Florida, like Space Pirate, he'll almost always wear Space Pirate because it goes from Cape Canaveral down and finishes in our town in Jensen Beach. And so I usually work somewhere else while he works that. So,
cool.
How
awesome.
And I'm age 67. So how many more years am I going to want to drive 60 or 70,000 miles a year and work 50 races?
Yeah, definitely. You know,
At this point, I think 5 or 6 more, maybe 10. But I think, you know, when I'm in my mid 70s or later 70s, I think I'm going to want to slow down. So unfortunately, I haven't found that person that would be the go-to person, the person who's young enough, but who wants to step in, because working ultras is a really, really dumb thing to do if you're a timing guy.
It very much is, because you got a lot of dead time.
It's really dumb. And here's how dumb it is that I was working Skydive Ultra one time in Clewiston, Florida. The year that I was working it, Eric had a 150-mile race. So we started like Friday morning and worked until Sunday evening. And so Dan, my son, worked a local 5K for us in the Stuart, Florida area. So when his race was over, he called me and he said, "Hey, I'm just calling to tell you that I finished the race up here. I'm going to email you the race files and all, so you can stick it, you know, you can file them away and look it all over and make sure that, you know, that everything's copacetic. And if anyone, you know, contacts you with any questions, you'll know what's going on." And he said, "Dad," he said, "I want you to know that in 6.5 hours this morning, I made more for us than you're going to make all weekend."
Oh my God.
And he said, I also want you to know that I'm okay with that. He said, "I'm willing to support your ultra habit."
That's awesome. And it's such truth.
I mean, truly, as a timing guy, if I really were in it for just the money, I would never, ever work an ultra. Way too much effort, way too much time involved, not nearly enough money, because a local 5K that's got 2 or 3 big money sponsors and 6 or 7 other people can clearly pay more than some ultra that's got 32 people who are going to run for 30 hours, you know?
Exactly.
But ultra is my jam. In general, they're the people who are going to stop their race to help you if you need help.
Yep.
Now, you don't find that very often now in triathlon or marathon. Our best society is when we care about each other. Like when I care as much about you as I care about me, that's a better society.
Yes.
And ultra, I think for the most part is still that way. Yeah. To me, the Dome, the Pettit Center is a near perfect venue to run a great race.
Yeah.
I think it's as good as you're going to ever find. The track could be a little spongier. If it were a little bit wider, it would be awesome. Bill and I feel really strongly that we want to put on races that we would want to run ourselves. And a great example of that is the portable toilets in the corners of the building.
Oh, yeah.
You know, there's perfectly adequate bathrooms in the lobbies.
Oh, yeah.
For us, you know, it's an $800 item to put those two portlets in there for the 10 days. And so I'm willing to spend that because I want all of us to be able to take one step in, one step out, and I'm back on the track.
Let's wrap this up because I know you're on the road up to Notch View and everything.
I do have a ton of stories, but thank you so much for hosting me. And
this has been great, Mike. Thank you for taking the time. Yeah. Really appreciate it.
Yeah, and I'm sure I'll see you in another race before the Dome at some point, because I think we'll run into each other.
I'm sure we'll see each other someplace. Absolutely.
Exactly.
All right. Thanks, Mike.
Thanks, man.
Thanks for listening. Really appreciate you guys. We'll see you next time on Living an Ultra Life.